Well, welcome to the international session, and we're going to be taking a little trip to Hawaii and other points where Hawaiian music has become popular and made a deep impression. Thank you for coming. Our first speaker is Amy Stillman from the University of Michigan. Is that correct? And Amy has published scholarly articles widely in order to secure tenure and promotion in academia. And I might be starting with the second page. There it is. Okay, so Leah, you just like take care of that in the editing. Yeah. So Amy Stillman is a professor of American culture and musicology at the University of Michigan and a two-time Grammy Award-winning co-producer and lyricist of Hawaiian music. Born and raised in Honolulu and a proud product of Hawaii's public school system and the University of Hawaii, she completed her doctorate at Harvard University and began her teaching career at University of California at Santa Barbara. She regrets she left just before the Cylinder Project took off. Now, Amy has published scholarly articles widely in order to secure tenure and promotion in academia. She has curated concerts of contemporary settings of archival repertoire and subsequent sound recordings, receiving both the Hawaiian Music Award and a nomination for a Nahoku Hanuhanu Award for liner notes. She lives in Ann Arbor with her husband and two cats who walk across her laptop keyboard when campaigning for food, which might explain some typos if she's got any handouts. The title of Amy's presentation is Beyond the Reef, Tracking the Global Circulation of Hawaiian Music Recordings. She assures you that Malcolm Rockwell regrets not being here this year, so please send some aloha his way. Amy Stillman.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for coming. This is my first outing at ARSC, and so I didn't realize the prevalence of the culture of including sound recordings in the presentation. So I did not plan any, also because I'm very nervous about embedding media in PowerPoint and seeing too many disasters with PowerPoint. So I didn't actually embed media, but I do have a hard drive full of examples for anybody who might be interested later on in hearing one or two of these gems. Okay, so since the dawn of the recording industry, records of Hawaiian songs have circulated globally. Okay. Hawaiian artists were recorded as they toured the continental United States, Europe, and Asia in the early years of the 1900s. At the same time, major American record labels were also sending field recording crews to Honolulu. These labels included Victor, Columbia, and Brunswick, all of whom had already developed extensive catalogs of Hawaiian music by the time Hawaii-based record labels entered the market in the mid-1930s. Hawaii-based labels had two objectives. First was producing music that could be consumed by local residents of singers and entertainers who were popular in Hawaii. And second, producing oral souvenirs for sale to visitors and tourists to remember their visit to Hawaii. Hawaii's statehood in 1959 triggered renewed interest in Hawaiian music across the United States. And the proliferation of Hawaii-themed albums surged forth with stereotyped representations and exaggerated caricatures of the indigenous heritage traditions of Hawaii's native Hawaiian people. In the vigorous reawakening of Hawaiian cultural expressions in 1970s Hawaii, the insistence of Hawaiian musicians to produce Hawaiian music on Hawaiian terms and in Hawaiian garb, apparently, sparked dramatic developments in Hawaii's recording industry and its media soundscapes. In the late 20th century, enthusiasm for rediscovering vintage music, especially from the era of acoustic recording technology, remastering and reissue enterprises brought sounds of Hawaiian music's distant past back into the present. Conventional chronicles of Hawaiian music have painted a history in which the continental U.S. music industry loomed large in the early and mid-20th century, then receded as Hawaii's recording and media industries became central in the commercial production of Hawaiian music. Sustained work on the discography of Hawaiian music recordings, however, is bringing to light a much more complex set of stories. My purpose here is twofold. First, I want to share some of the new insights from Hawaiian music recordings that are coming to light, and to reflect on how these insights might suggest some new directions in scholarship on discography. And second, I want to demonstrate how Hawaiian music provides a compelling case for underscoring the importance of researchers' accessibility to sound recording collections. My current discography work is part of a larger project of preparing a scholarly critical edition of Hawaiian songs. Tentatively titled Hawaiian Songs, Ancient and Modern, my volume is slated for inclusion in the series Music of the United States of America, affectionately referred to as MUSA. This series is published by the American Musicological Society and funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities. My overall goal in my volume is to illustrate distinctions among named genres in Hawaiian music, and I'm not going to go through this chart in great detail, but just want to make the point that there are named genres and there is an entire vocabulary of song and lyric classification. Much of this category has fallen out of use, so it has a history behind it, and that's one of the things I'm hoping to recuperate. If not the use, recuperate the use of these categories, then at least recuperate the awareness that at one time these categories were organizing rubrics. Okay, and my volume is, because this is a pretty much once-in-a-lifetime chance to put Hawaiian music in such a high visibility venue of national scope, my volume is ambitiously aiming to cover the entire spectrum of Hawaiian repertoire, from the kinds of the categories of oli and hula that we now call ancient Hawaiian music, all the way to the modern song types that we now call modern Hawaiian music. Since song genres have evolved over the past two centuries, it was crucial for me to select songs that could bear the burden of illustrating multiple and varying dynamics of stability and change. In addition to the structural distinctions identified by, In addition to the structural distinctions identifiable by musicological analysis, I sought to document distinctions in how different genres of songs circulated through the range of sources in which Hawaiian songs have been passed down from the past. I had already documented significant distinctions among song genres in printed and manuscript sources, namely in the modern section of the chart. The printed songbooks and published sheet music are dominated by the songs in the bottom three categories of himeni, mele Hawaii, and local song, well, less so local song. And hula kui songs appear in far less often in printed songbooks and published sheet music. The ratio of the hula kui songs to non-hula kui songs is something like 70% non-hula kui songs to 30% hula kui songs in the published songbook and sheet music sources. So I wanted to see whether there are distinctions in song genres among song among sound recordings of Hawaiian music. To test my hypothesis further that distinctions do exist in how song genres circulate, and that these distinctions are important, I turned to documenting the song's circulations on commercial sound recordings, hence my foray into discography work to explore ebbs and flows of popularity among songs and sectors within Hawaiian music. This innocent beginning led me into waters deep and uncharted far beyond the reef, literal and metaphorical. I started from the known, my own record collection, and what I could access at the University of Hawaii Library and Hawaii State Public Library. Honolulu collector and radio personality Harry B. Soria was an early collaborator and continues to answer my questions very patiently. I found my way to the record label discographies published in the 1980s and 1990s by Greenwood Press. And Michael Rupley's six-volume set on Decca Records was an incredible resource for me because Decca issued Hawaiian records prolifically in the 1930s and 1940s. Decca drew liberally on the labor of Hawaiian musicians working in the Hollywood film industry at the time, as well as on headliners such as Bing Crosby and Dorothy L'Amour and others who did have long relationships with Hawaiian music. By the year 2000, the internet was starting to make all kinds of resources available, and more importantly, keyword searchable. Early iterations of the All Music Guide website brought attention to dozens of Hawaiian music albums recorded by non-Hawaiian artists. And many of these albums were of the sort that were dismissed by collectors like myself, who we like to say we're more interested in the authentic rather than the ersatz. My interests, however, changed when I realized that having access to the physical artifact was really the ultimate means of confirming and verifying information. And voila, eBay. It was especially useful to me when sellers post detailed information. I filled in a number of gaps in my discography listings from eBay sellers postings shamelessly. Of course, I always bracket it and attempt to confirm or verify information through other sources, but eBay has been great for filling in gaps. More importantly, eBay has been crucial for me to actually get the records so that I could actually listen to the contents. Then I discovered the album discographies on the website of Both Sides Now Publications, which was begun by Mike Callahan and is now a team effort. And of course, a major cornerstone in my work is a magisterial award-winning discography of Hawaiian music in the era of 78 RPM recordings up to 1960, compiled by longtime ARSC member Malcolm Rockwell. I recount this process in part to emphasize this process of discovery of sources, in part to emphasize the convergence of exploration and serendipity in my pursuit, coupled with the necessity to actually access recordings in order to confirm information. The discography citations I amassed underwent several makeovers. So this is just a sampling of the first three pages of what is now over 35 pages long, discography of one specific song. It's very commonly known as Hawaiian War Chant, but it began life as a Hawaiian language song, love song, Kaua I Kahua Hawaii. Okay, so first of all, let me back up to more generally how these listings morphed into the form they're in now. First, I decided to list citations chronologically by date of release so that the list literally illustrates an itinerary of a song's travels among artists and record labels in different locations. Second, I had to decide how to handle reissues. And what I decided in the end was that I would group reissues of a track with the citation of the original recording of the track, or of a track's first known appearance. Needless to say, this presented several challenges, principal of which was the need to secure reliable dating information. And I may be the last person in this room to have learned that record companies have been historically inconsistent with including release dates on their products. The next challenge lay in how to present the information in citations in a consistent manner. Record label identifications needed to be accompanied by catalog numbers. And when I did not have the disc myself, I could not always depend on library catalogs to provide this information either. Before about the mid-1980s, the University of Hawaii did not include the record catalog number in their cataloging information. You could call up, you could do a keyword search on Hula Records and get 60 entries with no record catalog numbers in any of them. Okay, the citation formatting you see here reflects my own rationale for wrapping together standard citation information of artist, a record title, and record label with format and recording location in a way that I've been able to work out that distinguishes the reprints by enclosing release dates within parentheses from the primary recording in the citation, which is the very first one after the date. This when I did a copy and paste, the formatting got stripped. This is formatted on the two itineraries in a hanging indent format where the date is clearly out in the margin. In the what would I do differently next time category, I failed initially to maintain the numbering distinctions between mono and stereo issues and between LPs and the reissues on CDs. And this becomes important when record companies or record labels did not maintain the same numbering on the CD issue. Some record companies did, so HS560 becomes CD-HS560 on CD, but other record companies, you know, P4912 becomes SLP2214 on CD. It's a wonderful world of confusion out there. But I am trying to address this now retroactively as we go through on again and again, editing, checking, proofreading, whatnot. Now, through an acquaintance on Facebook in 2010, I finally connected with historian and collector John Marsden in Sheffield, England. This was a pivotal development because my own collection was limited by my bank account to recordings produced in the United States and Hawaii. John Marsden's collection is international in scope and is especially strong in Hawaiian music produced in Europe and in Japan. Although the University of Hawaii Library had purchased the collection of Dirk Vogel, which John Marsden insists is the one collection better than his own, it is most unfortunate that the Vogel collection remains boxed and in storage for lack of funding to catalog it, and thus it remains accessible to anybody's use. Even the librarians don't really know all of the details of what's in those boxes. Both Malcolm Rockwell and John Marsden became eager and earnest contributors to my project of these tune itineraries, and our collaborations produced dramatically expanded tune itineraries, and new perspectives began to appear out of the data. First of all, we began tracking where recordings were produced. I had always been separating Hawaii record labels out from those records produced by record companies on the US continent. It was now time to also draw out international locations that kept recurring, in particular Japan, Germany, England, the Netherlands, and Australia. And here are the first dramatic insights. There are distinctions in how songs have circulated, and those distinctions do relate to song genre as well as other historical factors. Now, one thing about these charts, all of the bars are color-coded, so the blue bar at the top is Hawaii. The red bar right under the blue bar is U.S. continental record labels. Japan is next in a gold color. So all of the color codings are up there. But you don't have to see every detail to see that there's a dramatic distinction going on here with the color bars, where Hawaii leads in the top chart. The continental U.S. is way ahead of everybody else in the second chart, and Japan edges out in the third chart. These bar charts represent raw counts of citations. The top example is a Hawaiian language hula kuʻi song circulating actively among Hawaii recording artists on Hawaii-based record labels. The middle chart is the 19th century Hawaiian language love song, Kaua I Kahua Hawaii, which was transformed in 1934 by a big band arrangement into Hawaiian war chant, also known by a bastardization of the original tongue-twisting title into Tahuwahuwai, or any permutation of syllables thereof. And there's about 9 different ways we found those syllables playing out on record jackets. These counts are preliminary and subject to checking and rechecking, but the general contour is clear. And I would also like to mention that there's different scales in all three charts. So I think the top chart has about 110 is the furthest tick mark out. Hawaiian war chant, the furthest tick mark out is at 300. And Beyond the Reef goes out to around 170 or so, okay? But still, again, the coloring in the bars really help to tell a very specific kind of story of what's going on here. English language songs, which Beyond the Reef at the bottom is an example of, these songs clearly enjoy greater popularity outside Hawaii. And Hawaiian language songs, such as Hi'ilawe in the top chart, clearly enjoy far less popularity outside Hawaii. The overwhelming prominence of Japan as a record-producing site owes its dynamics to the popularity of Hawaiian music there from the 1940s or even 1930s, the economic opportunities for Hawaiian musicians to tour Japan since the 1960s, and most recently the explosion in the popularity of Hawaiian hula in Japan since the 1980s, which brought with it, again, increased opportunities for musicians to tour and to record and to sell their recordings in Japan. When these raw counts are broken down into shorter time periods, even more nuance appears. So this chart shows the raw count of citations for Beyond the Reef in general, but I then broke it down into 4 periods, which are somewhat arbitrarily chosen. I'm not going to go into the rationale. There is actually some thinking behind the periods I chose, but they bore out exactly what I needed them to tell us about it. This is what the overall chart looks like. This is the period 1947 to 1961. This is the period 1962 to 1976, where gold pulls out ahead of red. This is 1977 to 1991, where things got quiet on the Beyond the Reef front. And this is 1992 to the present. Now, when song genre is considered, a more dramatic profile emerges. These two charts show respectively counts for a Hawaiian language himeni, or Christian hymn, and on top, and on the bottom, a Hawaiian language hula kuʻi song. Now, the successful conversion of Hawaiians to Christianity in the 1820s and 1830s means that hymns have been a part of Hawaiian experience for something like 7 or 8 generations. And to Hawaiians, especially Hawaiians who were brought up in the church as practicing Christians, himeni are as traditional as anything else. However, the notion of Christian Hawaiians is incommensurate with widely circulating ideas of exotic and ersatz primitivism. Hawaiian hymns do not, needless to say, appeal to listeners who are consuming primarily English language songs about Hawaii, like Beyond the Reef, as souvenirs of their visit or as signs of their fantasies. The case of hula kuʻi songs has a different factor, set of factors in play, and this is the bottom chart here. Listeners' attention spans are challenged not only by the Hawaiian language lyrics, but also by the fact that the songs are strophic, and more even more pertinent, there are short stanzas of usually 8 or 16 measures, are the norm, and the average hula kuʻi song has 4 or 5 verses, and some have a lot more. Very few have a lot less. Hawaiians do have a lot to say. Okay, so when you have a simple tune that is repeated 5 or 6 times in a foreign language, it holds limited appeal or interest for listeners who are unable to appreciate poetic aesthetics that are located in the lyrics. Hula kuʻi songs are of interest to instrumentalists, however, because they can use the tune repetitions to play variations and improvisations. And the hula kuʻi songs recorded in the mid-20th century by revered instrumentalists have entered this kind of canon among instrumental players, such as this particular song, Hi'ilawe, which was actually, there is a 1904 or 1906 recording of Hi'ilawe, which nobody has heard yet, not even Malcolm Rockwell or John Marsden. They haven't encountered the recording. But after that very first recording, there's this long period of no recordings of Hi'ilawe until Gabby Pahinoy records it in 1946 on Bell Records and goes on to record it 4 more times on different record labels. And Gabby Pahinoy has since been lionized by generations of slacky guitarists since, hence the great interest in this song in particular, Hi'ilawe. Okay, now another insight out of tracking and identifying the circulation of an individual track on subsequent releases, anthologies, and reissues. Oh, sorry. Whoops. Okay, Hi'ilawe, the whole chart, and then broken down into, again, these 25-year periods where you can see very specific kinds of dynamics going on, especially in activity on U.S.-based record labels and Japan record labels, and the next 2 time periods where Hawaiian presence becomes paramount once again. Okay, now, the marketing of ersatz Hawaiian music entered the sphere of the budget record labels, and what a tangled web I fell into. Through sheer perseverance, I and 2 research assistants took about 3 months. We followed several of the songs in my project, the individual songs in my project, into this world of the budget labels. Okay. On this slide, 1 track of Hawaiian War Chant on this Crown LP album in the upper left corner, this 1 track that was issued on Crown Records, it's a credited to an anonymous studio group called The Hawaiians. This track has appeared on at least 26 other budget LPs. At least, I say at least because every letter from John Marsden brings, oh, I found another one of our 1958 Hawaiian War Chant. So at this count, we're up to 26, and there's not 26 labels here, pictures of thumbnails of album covers here. Because I don't have all 26 of them. I have most of them, though. Okay, so this group, the Hawaiians, it's otherwise an anonymous group, right? Now, on the 26 budget LPs, though, the artists get credited variously. For example, Johnny Alunuai and his orchestra, Terry McKee and his band, and for graphic variety, Lani Okehu and his surfboarders, Harry Kaapuni and his Royal Polynesians, and the Waikiki Surfers. But the track is identical on all of these LPs. Okay? This was verified orally thanks, or perhaps no thanks, to eBay bringing these LPs to my mailbox. But what resulted out of all of this tracking of not only Hawaiian war chant, but Beyond the Reef, on the beach at Waikiki, and Drowsy Waters, Wailana, several other of songs I was tracking, are very much part of this orbit on the same compilations with Hawaiian war chant. Okay, so this chart maps relationships across these budget labels that my target songs have appeared on. And this chart was pieced together from record jacket information and a variety of websites and shows the labels on which these songs from my project appear. And I'm happy, hi. He's gonna help me sort through this mess. That is, of course, an excellent question. And that is, it's circumstantial evidence that can be put together. Crown was the primary record label for a group of Hawaiian musicians living in Los Angeles at the time who performed and gigged regularly as under the name The Polynesians. And they recorded over 10 LPs on Crown as The Polynesians. Okay, The Hawaiians is members of The Polynesians plus one of the Crown Record studio executives who was an amateur steel guitarist. So this holiday in Hawaii is his day to play. Hence, they're not billed as The Polynesians, they're billed as The Hawaiians, but it's essentially members of The Polynesians backing up this amateur steel guitar player. Okay, then Also, the other circumstantial piece of evidence that comes into play on the far right, Coronet CD that's attributed to Harry Kaapuni and his Royal Polynesians. Harry Kaapuni is Harry Kaapuni Beatty, who was the leader of the group The Polynesians for Crown Records. So it all fits together. And the Holiday in Hawaii LP on Crown is datable to 1958, whereas the bulk of these budget label reissues are really kind of more in the early 60s. Okay, these kinds of statistics and mappings tell a story about distinctions between different types of songs. In other words, the individual song is my unit of analysis. Scholarship and journalism are rife with examples of profiles of individual songs. For example, Ted Gioia's 2012 volume, Jazz Standards, and Will Friedwald's book, Stardust Melodies, are they're prominent examples of detailed profiles of individual songs. However, these song profiles tend to emphasize the history of the composition of the song, and when these writers discuss recordings of the song, the discussions are a majority of the time selected recordings. They choose the best recordings to talk about and recommend other people to listen to. What I'm doing in my project is just casting a wide net as comprehensively as possible. Where are these recordings coming from? Okay. My project of tracking individual songs globally tells a different kind of story through quantitative data that crosses national borders and music industry markets. My focus on the individual song also cuts across conventional discography rubrics of organizing discographies by record label, artist, or genre. The process of verifying individual song tracks is crucial to being able to link reissues with original issues. There is no substitute for actually consulting audio sound files. This means that access to the recordings and the means to listen to them is paramount. My project encountered multiple limitations on access to recordings. As I mentioned earlier, the Dirk Vogel collection at University of Hawaii Library is not accessible. Out of necessity, I began collecting LP records almost indiscriminately because acquiring them was the only reliable way I could access their contents. So, hallelujah, eBay. Now, in this process, I encountered yet one more challenge of finding limitations in even the most scrupulous discographies and the most enviable collections. The 49th State Record Company was the most prolific Hawaii-based record label in the mid-20th century. It began production in 1946 or 1947, at a time when the campaign for statehood in the territory fueled optimism that Hawaii would be the 50th state. Would be the 49th state. However, Alaska was admitted ahead of Hawaii in January of 1959. So when Hawaii was admitted in August of 1959, it became the 50th state. However, the 49th State Record Company kept its name and logo. You gotta love persistence, man. And so now when you look for 49th State Records on eBay, you type in 49th State, and you have to sift through all this Alaska memorabilia. And there's all this Hawaiian stuff mixed in. So, you know, it's perplexing to the Hawaiian people, and it's perplexing to the Alaska people, too. It's cool. Okay, 49th State Records began production during the 78 RPM era, focusing on hula songs for the market of hula studios and hula students in Hawaii. Their catalog centered on 350 singles, which, in addition to being co-issued on both 78, 10-inch 78, and 7-inch 45s, these singles became fodder for combining into 78 RPM albums, 10-inch LP albums, 12-inch LP albums, and 7-inch 45 RPM EPs. Yeah, okay. A listener's delight and the discographer's nightmare followed when record executive Michael Cord secured ownership of the 49th State catalog and in the 1990s began issuing new anthologies of this material, many curated by the collector and radio DJ Harry B. Soria. And their anthologizing is, it follows their own sense of preference and aesthetics that really cuts across the catalog in sometimes frustrating ways if you're real, I'll withdraw that. Cuts across the catalog in sometimes weird ways, period. Okay. The common assumption floating around about 49th State Records is that the singles are the basis for these subsequent repackagings across the various formats. The reality, however, is far more complicated. Here are the quantities of Hawaiian tracks that the companies issued on the entire spectrum of formats. Okay, so we have the 10-inch 78s and the 7-inch 45s, and notice the disparity on 78s, the series ended around 330, so there's 268 sides on the 78s, but a total of 350, so there is a section of the 45s that did not get issued on 78. Then various kinds of repackagings, which give us other numbers of total number of sides in those packagings. Okay. Preliminary guesstimates are that only about 60% of the singles were ever issued on any other format, and approximately 30% of the contents of the 12-inch LPs were never issued as singles. Malcolm Rockwell's discography is incredibly detailed with respect to the 78 RPM singles, and he does include streamlined data on the EPs in an appendix. Now, the EPs, mind you, were on 45s, and Malcolm very specifically set his parameters as focusing on the 78s. So I'm lucky that he included the EPs in an appendix, but he Okay. He did not, Malcolm did not include any reporting of information on the LPs, either the 10-inch or the 12-inch LPs. And okay, so when I attempted to discern what the level of overlap was and therefore identify the actual number of discrete sides that 49 state records produced, I could not do so on the basis of the song title alone. Many song titles, it turns out, were recorded by two or even three different artists. So this is a screenshot of my spreadsheet going on here of, and it picks up at Ke Kali Neau, which is more widely known outside of Hawaii as the Hawaiian wedding song. Okay, on 49 state records, the Hawaiian wedding song appears 14 times across the formats by five or six different artists. Here is my dilemma. Among the tracks that I have in my iTunes library, I hear six different arrangements. How do these arrangements map across the artists listed on the jacket covers or the disc labels? How does this map out if, in the case of the two EPs at the very bottom, which I've formatted in red font, when I only have the song title? Malcolm's appendix of the EPs contains only the song titles of the EPs, on the EPs. It turns out that his appendix was not based on an examination of the physical artifacts of the recordings, but rather derived from a printed catalog listing that did not include artist information. When I began searching in earnest for EPs and also for the transitional 10-inch LPs, I learned that many collectors, including both Malcolm and John Marsden in England, simply assumed that those formats duplicated the singles and chose to use their resources to acquire other things instead of collecting the EPs or the 10-inch LPs. So here's a total number of sides issued by 49 state records, kind of, sort of. This number is still open to revision. And I now own all of the 12-inch LPs, and I have been able to confirm the contents of all of the 10-inch albums. But I am now in hot pursuit of the EPs, and without confirmation of the EPs, I cannot actually do the last step of calculating out how many of this number or some number near it, 1,278, how many actual song titles and how many different arrangements of song titles are there across this 49 state catalog. So I am in hot pursuit of the EPs, and please wish me luck. So in conclusion, new insights on Hawaiian music are emerging of its travels far beyond Hawaii's reefs. We are fortunate that Malcolm Rockwell has completed excellent work on the 78 RPM era. I am far less fortunate that the LP complexities ramp up exactly where Malcolm left off. Along the way, though, I have learned much about the science and art of discography, and I hope that this project contributes in some small way to encourage the continuation of documentation efforts in discography. Thank you.
Mahalo. I'm going to ask you to please hold your questions till the end of the session.